The world was sweeter than we knew. Everything was ours. How happy we were then. So once upon a time, never comes again.
That was Jane McShann, piano and vocals, Once Upon a Time, from his album Just a Lucky So-and-So on the Sackville record label. The saxophonist was Jim Galloway. We opened that set with a duet with Jackie Byard and Earl Hines. It's 4 o'clock, this is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. In 1 hour, we'll be joining National Public Radio for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. Tonight on All Things Considered, reaction to President Reagan's address to the nation last night. The president is pressing lawmakers to approve U.S. aid for Nicaraguan Contras. Also on the St. Patrick's Day, a celebration with traditional Irish folk music, and a report on how the Irish are often stereotyped in greeting cards. Those are some of the things coming up at 5 o'clock tonight on All Things Considered. That will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. Well, with me now for a return visit to Fresh Air is writer Chaim Potok, whose latest book, Davida's Harp, has just been published in paperback. One theme that unites Potok's fiction is the interplay between the religious and secular worlds. Potok is from a Hasidic Jewish immigrant family. Although he fulfilled their hopes that he'd become a rabbi, he left Hasidic Judaism, which took a fundamentalist approach to the Bible. After he was ordained, he decided to write books instead of taking a congregation. His first book, The Chosen, was a bestseller and was made into a film a few years ago. His other novels include My Name is Asher Lev, The Promise, and The Book of Lights. He also wrote the best-selling nonfiction book, Wanderings, A History of the Jews. Potok recently served as secretary of the Committee of Scholars, which translated the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, into contemporary English and also brought it up to date with modern scholarship. The Jewish Publication Society brought out the translation in 1982 in three different editions. It was brought out in three different volumes, and a new one-volume edition of the translation has just come out. Chaim Potok lives in Philadelphia. His latest novel, Davida's Harp, has just been published in paperback by Fawcett Books. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
It's good to be here.
Last few times we talked about Davida's Harp, and we talked about the translation of the Hebrew Bible. I'd like to take this opportunity to talk about you and your life and a kind of retrospective of the novels that you've written. You grew up in a very Orthodox family. How would you describe the Hasidic religion, the way it was practiced in your home?
Ours was a very traditional family. You would categorize it today as a fundamentalist family. Devout observance of the Sabbath and the festivals, prayer three times a day, very kosher home. And I attended parochial schools from the time I was about 5.5 years old until I was graduated from Yeshiva College, which was a parochial Jewish parochial university at the age of about 20, so that my whole spectrum of early education, elementary school, high school, college, was all within the Orthodox fundamentalist fold. My father and my mother were both members of Hasidic groups. My mother, a descendant of one of the great Hasidic dynasties, a direct descendant of the son of one of the sons of the founder of that dynasty. We call it the Rishener dynasty in Europe. It was virtually wiped out in the Holocaust. And my father, a member of a Hasidic group called the Belzer Hasidim. I grew up inside that world. I remember the little synagogue in which I prayed from the time I could pray as a little child until my early years in college when problems began to develop.
When you were growing up, was it okay for you to mix with the outside world, or were you expected to keep within the Hasidic community?
I think that's one of the fundamental problems that confronts all people today. That is to say, you grow up inside your own particular world, learn its systems of values, are expected to adhere to those values. But because of the nature of the world in which we live today, very early on you're going to find yourself in confrontation with ideas and values that are going to come to you from outside your small world. In essence, that's what I'm trying to explore in my books, what happens in a confrontation of that kind. And all of us experience that confrontation. It really makes no difference where we come from, whether we brought up religious or whether we're brought up secular. It's a new confrontation. 200 and more years ago, most people on this planet never encountered a new idea or a stranger in an entire lifetime, unless you were a member of the aristocracy or the clergy or the military. You lived and you died inside a 25-mile radius of the place where you were born and never met a stranger or a new idea. This confrontation with new ideas is really new insofar as the experience of our species is concerned. And so very early on, I began to encounter worlds of ideas from outside the tight parameters of my own small orthodox world. And there was no way that my parents could keep me from that sort of encounter. All you had to do was turn on the radio, open a book that you picked up in a library. The only way you could stop this sort of encounter is by shutting yourself off entirely. And the effort to do that is enormous. Some people do that. Some groups try to do that. We were not in that sort of a world.
Were there things that set you apart from other people? Did you have to dress in a certain way or wear the long sideburns that many Hasidic people have to wear?
My father didn't do that. He was very much involved in the business world, and so he pretty much wore the garb of everyone around him. We wore the long fringed garment under our shirts. I remember wearing that when I was a little child. The tzitziot, they're called, the garment with the four corners to which long fringes are attached. The very Orthodox today wear them outside. They're closer that you sort of see them hanging along the pants. I wore them under my shirt. I wore that through my college years. Indeed, I wore that through my seminary years and into my first months in the United States Army.
What was it like for you to be set apart that way if someone only needed to look at you to know what your religion was and to know that you were very Orthodox?
Because you were part of a broader community and you were nurtured by that community, there was always a community to fall back on. You weren't the only one set apart. The entire community was separated from the rest of the world, and you were part of that separated community. Now, it became increasingly difficult to remain part of that community as I grew older, but that was caused not so much by the belief system of the community as by a belief system that I stumbled upon in my early teens, and that was, interestingly enough, a belief system born from literature.
But, you know, I grew up in Brooklyn, and there were, when you take the train past mm-hmm. one of the Hasidic communities or go to parts of Manhattan where there are a lot of Hasidic people, everyone would make fun of them because they were wearing dark clothes, they had the long sideburns, they were wearing religious garments, and they looked in some ways not unlike the Amish people, which is perhaps a more familiar image to our listeners. And did you ever feel like you were looked at as an object of ridicule by other people? And I don't just mean by non-Jews here, because Jewish people who weren't Orthodox would frequently make fun of the Orthodox people and the way they dressed and
the way they looked. Oh, yes, there was always that problem of being different from the rest of the world. For example, I always walked around with a skullcap on my head. It was inconceivable that I would go anywhere without that. In the summertime, that's what you wore no matter how hot it might be. You were always the object of attention. You have to remember that I grew up in the 30s at a period of time in the United States when anti-Semitism was as rampant as you could possibly imagine it to be in the United States and still not be part of the political scene. I grew up at a period of time when Father Kugel's anti-Semitic radio programs would come blaring at us through the open windows in the street where I lived. One was very conscious of one's Jewishness, and at the same time one was very conscious that there were lots of people out there who didn't like you for what it was that you were.
Were you warned by your parents to not mingle outside of the Jewish community?
Repeatedly. And one didn't mingle with people outside the Jewish community. One tried very hard to stay away from them because there were quite a few times when some of my friends would come home beaten up by the various, non-Jewish groups in our neighborhood.
You said a minute ago that it was literature that opened up your experiences beyond the neighborhood that you lived in and beyond the ideas that you got from that neighborhood and from your parents? What were you reading that...
I was about 15 years old when I read for the first time a serious adult novel. Quite by chance. I wanted to read an adult novel. I had time on my hands. It was at the end of a high school term for me. I was done with my exams. And for a reason that isn't quite clear to me to this day, I decided I would take a crack at a really tough adult novel. And I went to the library and found, of all things, Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh. It's a story that I've told a number of times. I owe an extraordinary debt to that strange Englishman who's probably as amazed as I am that he affected a nice Jewish boy from New York in the way that he affected him. But I remember reading that story and finding myself utterly lost inside the book, not so much lost inside the storyline as much as I was lost inside the people and their feelings. I had read books before, but always there was a sense of the reading experience. That was the first time in my life when I actually lost sense of the reading experience and found myself feeling the feelings of the people. Now, Brideshead Revisited is about upper-class British Catholics in the decades before the Second World War. I was a yeshiva student, a boy from a Jewish parochial high school, and, of course, you can imagine that I knew a great deal about upper-class British Catholics. I had never had a reading experience of that kind before. I remember closing the book, looking down at it, and feeling utter amazement at the power of the human imagination that could create a so vivid a world that a reader from so distant a world could find himself utterly lost inside that world. And that's where the commitment to write was born. I don't fully understand it to this day. Things happen to teenagers sometimes. They pass and are dissipated, and sometimes what happens so locks with the inner being of the teenager that dreams are born, and you spend the rest of your life trying to chase that dream, and that's what happened to me. It was a result of reading Brideshead Revisited that I entered the world of modern literature.
It sounds like reading that book also convinced you that there were many valid experiences and many valid worldviews and valid religions, and that it was interesting to find out different views beyond the one that you were born into.
Yes, indeed. Looking back on it, I think that there were two components to that experience. One was the sudden awareness that there were other people who were having my kinds of religious experiences. That is to say, I was reading about a closed Catholic world, and all I had to do was use the frames of reference of that world, translate them into my own, and sense that I was really living that kind of experience in my own life. The second component has to do with a nascent rebellion that I was probably entering into. And one of the ways I translated that rebellion was through the medium of aesthetics, especially aesthetics not entirely acceptable to the Jewish tradition, that is to say, modern storytelling.
When you had that experience of being changed through literature, how did it start changing your life? You were a yeshiva student then. You were still Orthodox. Did you start making radical changes quickly?
No. I began to read, and I began to write. And as the years went by, I discovered that reading modern literature brought me into a tradition. It's a tradition that's about 300 years old. It has, in English, it has its beginnings with the epistolary novels of Richardson, the novels written in letter form in England in the 1700s. And I discovered, too, that fundamental to that tradition is a certain way of looking at the world. And it's essentially the form of expression used by individuals who grow up inside established societal norms and, for whatever the reason, find themselves at odds with those norms, find themselves in a state of rebellion. They look at those norms and begin to sense the games that people play, the hypocrisies that are very often the mechanisms of defense by means of which we make our way through this very tough business we call living, the masks that people wear. And sometimes those individuals break with that world if that world becomes intolerable to them. They break and never return, or they break and return, or they make their peace with that world, join it, and forget their rebellion. And for the past 300 years or so, some individuals on the western side of our planet have been using this old form of human expression, storytelling, for the purpose of exploring this extraordinary experience, this tension between private and public worlds. And this is what nurtured me all through my teens as I was reading the great masters who create modern literature, this sense of personal vision on this rather extraordinary modern rebelliousness. It's very difficult to be filled with this kind of experience and not have it in one way or another alter your way of structuring the human experience. By the time I was 18, 19, going into my 20s, I began to feel that if I was going to be a serious writer, it would really be impossible for me to remain inside a fundamentalist world with very rigid, structured parameters and find full expression for what it is that I wanted to say.
My guest is writer Chaim Potok. His latest novel, Davidus Harp, has just been published in paperback. Now, if you had stayed in the fundamentalist world and wanted to write, you'd be coming from a tradition where the Bible was seen as the revealed word and was to be taken literally, which would have interesting implications for a writer trying to use metaphor and allegory in their fiction. Could you have actually stayed a Hasid and written fiction at the same time?
I don't think so. I think that, for me at any rate, it really was inconceivable that I could have remained inside a fundamentalist world and done the sort of maneuvering that I felt was necessary to do. I know that there are writers who are deeply devout and are great writers. Agnon, for example, the Hebrew writer, was a very religious man for all of his adult life. He didn't start out as a very religious man, but he certainly became one early on and remained one all of his life, and struggled with the tension between his form of expression and his religiousness. I know that Flannery O'Connor was a very devout Catholic, but my feeling is that Flannery O'Connor and Graham Greene really found their own niche or created their own particular Catholic worlds inside their writing. It would have been really impossible for me to remain a fundamentalist Jew and do the sort of writing that I wanted to do, because the sort of writing that I wanted to do really required eyes that were outside, eyes that were upon the world, not eyes that were part of the world that I was trying to explore. I was really concerned about writing in the final analysis public relations.
Did you take an action that was your first big symbolic break with your past and with that tradition?
The action was very overt, very blunt, and it came a few months before I was graduated from Yeshiva University, which was and is an Orthodox school, although a modern Orthodox school, rather a sophisticated school. I was asked to stay on at Yeshiva University after graduation and teach in the English department there. I was majoring in English. And instead of doing that, I decided to go to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, which is a non-Orthodox, non-fundamentalist rabbinical school. And I went there not to become a rabbi. I went there in order to learn another angle of vision on the Jewish tradition. I knew by the time I was about 18 or 19 years old that I would write about Jews. What else did I know to write about? I didn't know what I would write about, but I knew that I would write about the Jewish experience. And I also knew that I was getting essentially an Eastern European education, which is essentially a fundamentalist education. And I also knew that there had to be whole elements of the Jewish tradition, whole elements of Jewish civilization that I was simply not being taught in my fundamentalist world. Where was its philosophy, its poetry, its storytelling? Now, where was the whole spectrum of Jewish civilization? The only thing I was being taught was Talmud. And at that time, my cousin married a student at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and we began to talk. And I decided that I would go to the Jewish Theological Seminary because that was the place where I would get a Western scientific orientation to the Jewish tradition. And in retrospect, it was one of the better choices that I made in my life, because what it did was fill me in on whole areas of Jewish learning, Jewish thought, and the Jewish experience that I simply wasn't receiving before. What it did essentially was give the Jewish experience a historical dimension. And that's what you need very, very much if you're going to be a serious writer.
Let me ask you a weird question here. How come you didn't leave religion altogether? Because you made a break with your past, but you kept with religion. You remained very religious and very, very committed to the Jewish tradition.
My feeling is that if there were no alternatives to orthodoxy or fundamentalism in the Jewish tradition, as, for example, there were no alternatives for James Joyce with his Catholicism, that I probably would have left the Jewish tradition entirely. The point is that I had an alternative. I had a non-fundamentalist reading of the Jewish tradition that I went to. I did not have to go the way of James Joyce.
D- Did your parents perceive this as an attack on them and their families and their heritage?
My father was very unhappy with the choice, but of course I was of an age where he could do nothing about it. I think that he didn't quite make his peace with that choice.
So it must have been hard for you.
It was very hard. It was also hard because when you make a choice of this kind, you really break with your past entirely. You wipe out your whole early life. It's interesting that friends don't talk to you anymore. Teachers don't talk to you anymore. It's as if you have to rebuild your life entirely. It's quite as if you are suddenly without a history. It isn't just a matter of changing schools. It is a matter of changing worlds. And it was a very difficult choice to make.
Did your personality change?
I think that it did change. It probably became more worldly, more sophisticated, more Western-oriented. I would think that it did.
After studying to become a rabbi and then after being ordained, you decided to never actually take on a congregation and to write instead. Can you explain that decision?
Well, I had always wanted to write, and I was going to the seminary in order to learn my subject better. I never intended to be a pulpit rabbi and have never been a pulpit rabbi. I don't think I could have been a pulpit rabbi and been a writer simultaneously. I think being a pulpit rabbi is an enormous commitment and is a total drain of one's creative energies, and I don't see how anybody could possibly do both creatively. I really became an educated Jew, as it were, a Western educated Jew, for the purpose of knowing my subject better. Indeed, just as I later on went to the University of Pennsylvania and took a doctorate in general philosophy in order to learn better the general civilization about which I was going to write, because I'm writing about those, the confrontation of those two civilizations.
Then I guess the closest you came to having a congregation was when you were a chaplain in the army during the Korean War.
That was precisely right. That's the closest I came to actually having a congregation, and it was, I must say, an extraordinary experience. The year and a half I spent in Korea, a few years after the end of the war, when things were still very bad there.
What made it extraordinary for you?
The intense feelings of people, the meeting of rather terrible conditions of all kinds of human beings, the commitments that one makes in periods of great stress, the friendships that one forms. Things happen on fields of combat that simply don't happen in ordinary life, and relationships are born that still hold for me. Some of my closest, deepest, most marvelous friendships were formed in that period of time.
It certainly took you far away from the world you'd been brought up in.
Everything that I brought with me to Korea disintegrated under the impetus of that confrontation. I brought a very neat, coherent model of my Americanism and my Judaism there. And nothing was the same when I came back home. I met, interestingly enough, a world where Judaism simply doesn't figure as a category of thought. I had always been brought up to believe that Judaism was crucial in Western civilization, as indeed it was. One cannot conceive of Western civilization without its Jewish component. And there I lived for 15 and a half months in a civilization where Judaism simply doesn't figure at all, and it gets along very well without Judaism. It doesn't need it at all. I had always been brought up to believe that paganism was an abomination. And I lived among pagans, and it is not an abomination. There are some things about the pagan world that are absolutely exquisite.
What do you mean when you say pagan?
A civilization that is essentially idolatrous, where the focal point is nature, cycles of nature, and images and idols that are representative of those cycles of nature. Fructification of the earth, the agricultural cycle, the natural cycle, and so on. It's a beautiful world. And there was much in it that I felt profoundly in love with. I remember, for example, wandering through Tokyo once and stopping off at a Shinto shrine in a market district and seeing there an old man praying before an idol, Shinto idol, dressed in a bedraggled coat and a felt hat and a brownish suit. and holding in his hands some sort of prayer book and shaking back and forth in front of the idol. And I looked at him, and the first thing I remembered were the old Jews that I used to pray with in this little Hasidic synagogue that I grew up in. And I remember asking myself at that point, what am I looking at? Is the God that I pray to listening to this man's prayers? If the God that I pray to is not listening to this man's prayers, why not? Because I cannot conceive of a human being praying with greater devotion than I was witnessing in that Japanese man at that point. And if the God that I pray to is listening to this man's prayers, then what are Judaism and Christianity all about? So I came away from the Far East with the spectrum of questions to which, to this day, I don't have full answers. And what happened was that my whole world was rendered ambiguous. And it is this world that I'm trying to explore in my fiction. And what I did was I started backwards. I began to explore the components of that fixed world that I brought with me to Korea and slowly began to experiment with and explore the world that I actually encountered in Korea and what happened when those two worlds met.
My guest is writer Chaim Potok. The first novel that you wrote was The Chosen.
That's right.
It ended up being a bestseller, but you had no way of knowing that it would be. Did you think you were taking a great risk for the financial stability of your family to try to become a professional writer?
Oh, yes. I was at the time working as editor of the Jewish Publication Society, so there was some measure of stability in our lives. Although, indeed, that was when The Chosen was published. When I actually wrote The Chosen, I wasn't working at anything. I was finishing up my doctoral dissertation for the University of Pennsylvania. We were living in Jerusalem at the time, and we were, to say the very least, rather penurious. I mean, we had real money problems. If it weren't for the fact that my wife was working as a psychiatric social worker, I don't know what we would have done in order to keep ourselves alive. So that, yes, there were real risks that were taken. And I think that sooner or later in the life of anyone who wants to be any kind of artist, serious risks have to be taken, and you have to be ready to fail.
What were some of the personal and religious themes that you were wrestling with at the time that ended up in your novel, The Chosen?
I was wrestling essentially with the problem of what happens when an individual who grows up inside the core of a particular tradition, knows that tradition really well, attended its best schools, and is committed to that tradition, loves it, comes up at the same time against elements from the general civilization in which we all live and finds himself passionately committed to those elements, isn't quite sure why, but suddenly these elements open tremendous windows, powerful personal visions into the nature of the world or the nature of man. And The Chosen particularly deals with Freudian psychoanalytic theory, which is thoroughly inimical to any Western religion's view of the human being, man, and his relationship to other men, and so on and so forth. That's the essential thrust of The Chosen. In other words, how do you come to terms with a system of ideas that seems to be hostile to your own system of ideas, and at the same time, you see in that hostile system of ideas elements of real truth, of profound insight into the nature of man, that your own system of ideas doesn't have? What do you do in a situation of this kind when you find yourself falling in love with opposites? Opposites. That was the essential thrust of The Chosen. It's an intellectual problem. I deal with it on a feeling level because novels shouldn't be enterprises or experiments of the intellect as much as they really should be explorations of human relations and human feelings. And I'm interested in the feeling component of this kind of culture confrontation. And as I said earlier, all of us have experiences of this kind because all of us come from particular worlds and bump up against ideas from worlds outside our own.
Although all of us experience that, not everybody experiences it from the Jewish perspective, which is what you wrote about.
That's right.
When you were writing it, did you think, well, this is going to have a pretty narrow market? You know, who's going to, how broad of an audience is this really going to appeal to?
It's interesting. I never really remember thinking of the audience. What I remember thinking about over and over again was the need to get this thing to be as true as I possibly could get it to be. I think that if I had really thought about the audience, it wouldn't have come out the way it was. Because what could be narrower, indeed, than Hasidic Rebbe giving a long speech about one's commitment to Torah and to study and to Jewish peoplehood and so on and so forth. I was really concerned about getting it right, getting it to sound truthful. And my feeling always was that if I could get it to sound truthful, I could get as broad a spectrum of people interested in reading it. Because after all, I remember when I grew up, I read about very narrow worlds. What is narrower than the world of Brideshead Revisited with its upper-class British Catholics? And yet I, as an Orthodox Jew, was able to lock with that world. What's narrower than the Irish Catholic world of James Joyce in Dublin? And yet I, as a Jew, was able to lock with that world. Why would it not be possible for non-Jews to lock with my particular world?
One of the characters in The Chosen basically renounces fundamentalism. He leaves his Hasidic family in a way like you did. Was the book considered to be a renunciation of fundamentalism? Did it get you into a lot of trouble with family and friends and synagogues?
He doesn't so much renounce his fundamentalism as he renounces his particular allegiance to that brand or group of fundamentalists. That's correct. And indeed, there were many who said, why do you have to write about somebody who comes out of his encounter with less than what he went into it with? There were those who said, why don't you write about people who enter into an encounter with another system of values and come out with it either intact or with more than the beginning of the encounter? That wasn't my experience. I was interested in exploring what it was that meant most to me. And the sort of experience that Danny Saunders and Reuven Walter had was the experience that I was most interested in exploring as a novelist.
Do you think there's some of you in each of those characters?
There's some of me in each of those characters, indeed, yes.
How were you treated critically after the publication of that book? Were you typed into the Jewish American Writer, and how do you feel about that label?
Well, I think that what I do is use a certain American experience as my territory for exploration, very much the way Faulkner used a certain Southern experience as the territory for his exploration, and John Updike uses small town Pennsylvania as the experience, as the raw material for his exploration, and so on. I understand the need for categorizing because one has to organize one's material and teach in universities and do books of criticism and so on. An American writer with a certain territory that happens to be a certain sort of Jewish experience, but that Jewish experience is pretty much the experience of lots of people in the 20th century. And what I'm doing is exploring that broader experience through the concrete specifics of the Jewish experience about which I know best. A writer who writes seriously writes about a specific, small, particular world. The same is true of Tolstoy, who writes about the vastness called Russia, but uses small worlds, families, individuals to explore that vastness. Faulkner did it. Cheever did it. Hemingway did it. You read Hemingway and you think that everybody was an expatriate after the First World War. There were only a handful of expatriates in Paris. You use small worlds. You put your eyes upon those worlds. You try to get as close to the cores of those worlds as you possibly can as a novelist. Many times what you see is not so terribly pleasant. Yours is the responsibility to record that unpleasantness. Novelists are not writing public relations. Everybody who writes seriously writes about small worlds in the hope that other people who come from small worlds will somehow lock with the world of the novelist.
Do you feel part of a larger school of Jewish American novelists?
I think that what we call Jewish American novelists can be organized if we have to do the organizing in the following way. There are many ways that we encounter other ideas and other cultures. I'm writing about individuals from the heart of one culture, the core of one culture, encountering ideas from the heart of a general civilization in which we all live, and to which we all contribute the best of our creative energies. We are that civilization, all of us. So if I had to create a category, I would call that a core-core confrontation of ideas, core of one, core of the other in confrontation. Somebody like Philip Roth, for example, essentially deals with individuals along the periphery of things Jewish, and to a very great extent along the periphery of Western civilization. And that might be called a periphery confrontation of cultures. That's especially true of his early work. Saul Bellow, in a novel like Herzog, is dealing with an individual on the periphery of things Jewish and at the same time right at the heart of Western civilization. So that might be a periphery core confrontation of cultures. Now, each of these confrontations has a different kind of dynamics, and different results come out of those confrontations. I think you might make the same case out for Southern writers, by the way. You probably could make the same case out for people like Cheever and Updike and others who are Protestant writers. All writers are trying to deal with different elements of this kind of core confrontation. The most worked-over confrontation in the modern novel really is periphery-periphery. Madame Bovary, for example. All of Hemingway's characters are periphery-periphery confrontations. The classic, for me, the paradigmatic core-core confrontation is James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.
Do you feel that your approach to the structure of the novel has changed with the development of your writing?
Yes, I think it's become more nuanced and more subtle. Interestingly enough, more difficult for some people to really grasp, because I'm one of the novelists who believes that the story is very important in a novel. And people sometimes have a tendency to believe that there's too much story in my books. Story is a kind of surface patina in my work. It's a way I have of gluing things together. The novels are multifaceted now. I think that The Chosen is pretty much all on the surface, at least to a very great extent, whereas a book like Davita's Harp is a sort of a prism. You turn it one way or turn it another way, and the whole thing pivots, and you can just look at it in different ways. I couldn't write that kind of novel when I was writing The Chosen.
My guest is novelist Chaim Potok. You know, it's interesting. We've been talking about how you left the fundamentalist Jewish world, and you've been talking about the different perspectives that you've seen since leaving. And there really has been a resurgence of fundamentalism in America, of both Christians and Jews, because I think that a lot of Jews who were brought up in conservative or reform or very secular homes have turned to Hasidism, which is one of the Orthodox branches of Judaism. And I wonder if you have any theories about why that's happening now, why the return, especially in some areas of younger people, to fundamentalism.
I think that we're living at a period of time when all the great ideas that formed Western humanism are in considerable trouble. There wasn't a greater optimism in the history of our species, I think, than the optimism that pervaded Western civilization about the turn of the century. We really felt that we could solve all of our problems. We really thought that we finally had a handle on things. Science really understood the essential nature of the universe. Psychoanalytic theory really was beginning to understand the essential nature of man. And you read the literature that came out at about the turn of the century until the First World War. It is bursting with optimism. First World War is really the watershed of the 20th century, and one can make out a very strong case that the First and Second World Wars were really one long world war with a little rest period in between for rearming. We're tired. Western civilization is in a weary phase. Postmodernist Western civilization is really in a period where it is reevaluating its fundamental aspects. When you get a situation of this kind, and when at the same time you bring up generations of young people faced with the constant specter of total destruction, what happens is that you get a turn toward old truths, a hunger for authenticity, and more important than anything else, you get a hunger for community. Western humanism, with all the great things that it has given our species, particularly the great idea of personal freedom, has, for whatever the reason, been unable to create a sense of community. That is to say, rootedness, one person solidly enmeshed with another, support systems of human beings that will take human beings through this tough, tough business we call trying to live in this world. This hunger and this disillusionment, coupled together, have brought on the search for old truths, old values, powerful rooting in support systems we call communities. And it isn't only Judaism that's experiencing this now. Clearly, all the major religions on the planet are experiencing this resurgence of fundamentalist belief. That is to say, a movement to old ideas, ideas that have been around for thousands of years. The Jewish experience is simply participating in this. And it isn't only the Orthodox Jewish experience. The Reform movement is participating in this now, too. The conservative movement is participating in this now, too. Catholicism is witnessing a powerful resurgence of its more rightist elements. And clearly the Shiite experience in Islam is a manifestation of this return.
Well, as a religious man, I wonder what you think. You know, if I think it's a good or a bad impulse.
I think that it is both. And one has to be very careful about this kind of return. For me, I think it's very important that there be an opportunity for young people to find themselves in community and in what they regard as authenticity. It is terrible to think that the spectrum of human experience has nothing to offer young people who are looking for profound religious experiences. At the same time, one has to be very careful about this, because one of the spin-offs of fundamentalism is the rhetoric of absolute truth. And absolute truth is antithetical to a democratic way of living. We are a delicately balanced society in Western civilization. If one group begins to assert itself in such a way that it upsets this delicate balance, we stand the real possibility of destroying what we call democracy. I have no quarrel with anyone who professes fundamentalist belief. Quite the contrary. I have very profound regard for such individuals. I grew up in that world, and I love that world, in spite of the quarrels that I might have with it. That's the world that I'm trying to understand, trying to explain, trying to explore in my fiction. But once that world asserts that it and it alone has the monopoly on what it is the truth is all about, that world becomes, in its most essential nature, a threat to the fundamental aspect of Western civilization, Western democracy as we know it now. Now, I know that monotheism is, by definition, antithetical to democratic ways of life. By definition, monotheism says that it has the answers. Now, one of the great tasks, I think, for the future of monotheism is to learn somehow how to live both with its assertion of truth and at the same time with the notion of tolerance. Understanding. There has got to be a way of balancing the sense of truth that you have with a profound respect for another vision of the human experience.
Which is, again, getting back to the theme that unites all of your fiction.
That's right.
My guest is Chaim Potok. It's interesting that you, who were brought up as a fundamentalist, was on the committee of scholars that recently completed a new translated of the Hebrew Bible. So the book that you were brought up with as being the revealed in the literal word was the book that you were trying to find more contemporary English words for and to bring up to date with modern scholarship. Must have been a real emotional experience as well as intellectual experience for you.
It was. It was an extraordinary experience. Also, in a sense, it was a metaphor for everything that I've been talking about here, because here was the central sacred text not only of the Jewish tradition, but of the Western tradition generally. And what we were doing with that text was applying to it ideas that were coming to us from the heart of secularism, because we were applying to it scientific Bible criticism, linguistics, archaeology, all the powerful tools that were born at the very heart of Western secular humanism in the last two centuries. And we were trying to fuse together the cores of two great cultures, the Jewish with this great text, the Christian for that matter too, and at the same time the secularist instrumentalities that we were using. It was an extraordinary experience, and very often that we would stop dead in our tracks as we tried to evaluate to which of these two powerful cultures do we owe the greater allegiance. How do you handle a text? How do you dissect a text that at the same time you have profound respect for? We like to think that most of the time we succeeded in effecting a fusion of these two great cultures. I know that there are those who disagree with us, but I think that what we've done is create a great translation.
Well, maybe we could just take a moment here to compare one of the newly translated lines with the original line.
Some of the translations are rather obvious as you go through the text, but one of them that has caused us no end of difficulty has to do with the psalm that talks about the Valley of the Shadow of Death. The Valley of the Shadow of Death comes about as a result of the fact that the original Greek translation, the Alexandrian Jews who did the translating, lost the meaning of the word in Hebrew. In the Hebrew text that they had, the word that is spelled by the consonants, tsalmut, had been lost to them. Just as, for example, there are words in Elizabethan English that, if we didn't have dictionaries, would be lost to us today. Well, they looked at that word, and what they did was they saw in it two words that they did know. And you have to remember that the texts in those days had all the words and all the letters running together. So they saw the two words that they did know, and those two words were tzela, tzel, and mavet, mut, mavet. And they translated that into the Greek, shadow of death. Because they understood tzel, shadow, and they understood mavet, death. They did not understand tzalmut, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. Went into the Greek this way, and from the Greek it went into the Latin, and then it fed into the English language, and that's the way it was translated in King James. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. In the 20s of this century, an enormous archive was found in a city, an ancient city called Ugarit. It's on the coast of Palestine, Lebanon, somewhere in that area. And they dug it up. They found that archive. They begin to translate the material, and lo and behold, they have discovered a vast literature, a Canaanite literature. And it turns out that the ancient Canaanites were an extraordinary literate people with an extraordinary pantheon of gods and a highly sophisticated literature, not at all the barbarians and semi-barbarians that they're pictured to be in the Hebrew Bible. And lo and behold, they find the word tzalmut. And what they do is they match it against the word that they do know in a parallel text, because Canaanite poetry is in parallels. Very often, the first half of a verse will be repeated in the second half of a verse in different words. So if you know the first half, you can sort of guess at the second half if you don't know the second half. And lo and behold, the word tzalmut appears, and clearly it means deep as darkness. And so we translated it now as a result of this new knowledge that we have. Yea, though I walk through a valley of deepest darkness. Some rabbis complained that we had taken the word death out of that psalm and they could no longer use it at funerals. When you take out something that is so ingrained in the language, an image that's so powerful, a metaphor, you pay a high price for it. At the same time, what we wanted to do was get at the truth. These are the sorts of things that we encountered over and over again as we went through this work, this great work, this Bible, with the new knowledge that we had at our disposal.
Well, you know, the Bible serves a lot of functions, and one of them is that there's this book that has been passed on from generation to generation, and because we all know the language, because it's the same language that's been passed on, that language is our connection to history as well as the message the language gives. So when you change the language, it's like, you know,
but
cutting
nothing,
off that connection to the past.
That's right, but there's nothing intrinsically sacred about a translation. Indeed, one of the greatest of the medieval commentators, Rashi, sensed that the meaning of that word was deep darkness, and he said so, although he didn't know why it meant that way. He also had lost its original meaning.
Would you want to see people use both the say the King James translation and Jewish people use the new translation in parallel, to use them both so that they have that language connection to the past and also have a more kind of modern interpretation of what it actually means?
What we did was indicate that there was another translation, and we indicated in a footnote that this is the more or less old translation and that we now disagree with it. But I think it's important that people remember what that old translation is.
Do you ever think of the Bible as your book now? Because you worked on it so much?
To a great extent, yes, although I was just one of a number of people working on it. But it has a particular meaning to me now that it simply did not have in the past.
The work that you did on this indicates to me that you have a commitment to seeing religion change as the times change. I mean, just to see interpretations change with the times.
It always has. And we delude ourselves into thinking that it hasn't. The rabbinic Judaism is, I think, different in kind from biblical Judaism. We don't quite see it that way unless we understand fully what biblical Judaism was. My feeling is that everything changes, but religion changes probably the slowest of all. We don't perceive the change. We try to keep the change as minute and as infinitesimal as possible. But everything in this world undergoes some measure of change, religion as well.
Several of your books have dealt with people who are making a break with the religious commitment that they were brought up with. But your latest book, Davidas Harp, is in a way just the opposite of that, because she's brought up by two secular parents. Her mother's Jewish, her father's Christian, and they're very politically involved. I mean, they're activists, but they're political, secular activists. They just don't practice any religion at all. And she, by the end of the book, has turned to Judaism, and it's a real kind of turn of themes for you.
She hungers for community. That's what we talked about earlier. Her mother and father were profoundly involved in leftist causes in the 1930s, very intellectual people. And this girl hungers to be part of a group. She has no friends. They're constantly on the move. And while they love her profoundly, their focus of interest is clearly their work. And she doesn't know who she is. And she gravitates toward the Jewish community for a variety of reasons. And is embraced by that community, finds love in it, discovers the love that she has in herself for it, and then at the end is profoundly hurt by it, not for what she does, but for what she is.
Which is a woman.
That's right.
And it's, I think, the first book that you've really tried to tell from a woman's perspective, and I wonder why you did that.
The event actually occurred in somewhat different form to my wife when she was 13. She attended at the time a Jewish parochial school in New York, a mixed class of boys and girls. The best student in the class was automatically the valedictory, was given the valedictorian upon graduation, represented the class before the parents and the guests. She was the best student and was not given the valedictory. And when she asked why, she was told straight out that it was because she was a girl, and how would it look in the eyes of all the other schools in the neighborhood and in the area if the best student in this parochial school was a girl? It would shame the boys. There was a fuss. Her father taught in that school at that time, but to no avail, and she was not given the valedictory. She told me the story about the time that we were married, 27 years ago, and it sort of nestled in the place where stories of this kind nestle inside the being of novelists, and it came time to tell it. Also, her family was very much involved in the labor Zionist world. Somewhere there was a cousin involved in leftist causes, and there may even have been some sort of distant relative who might have been a card-carrying member of the party. Those two components of her life were enough to trigger my imagination as a novelist and form the core of Davidas Harp.
The fact that she is not taken seriously scholastically within Judaism, is that another indication to you that Judaism and other religions have to just rethink the role of women and adapt their own traditions to suit the times and to just open up to women?
Yes, I think we do violence to 50% of the species when we ignore the potentiality of women. It's inconceivable to me that some of the most sophisticated women I know are Orthodox women. people who were professors in universities and executives in corporations would not conceive of being treated as second-class citizens in their places of work, and at the same time, as they enter a synagogue, are very clearly marked as second-class citizens. Now, I understand the rationale. I understand how deeply respected the Jewish woman is in the traditional Jewish family. At the same time, I find it very difficult to make my peace with their role in Judaism. I find it very difficult to make my peace with the way they're treated and the fact that they have to sit behind a partition, the fact that they can't approach God quite on the same terms as their husbands. And I say again, I fully understand the reasons, the rationale, and simply can't accept it.
Your life and your literature has been an attempt to understand your own tradition and find a way for you to kind of communicate within your own religion, and at the same time to respect other religions and other worldviews, other cultures, and not accept one as the ultimate truth, thereby negating any validity that the other has. Do you feel like you've been able to actually do that in your life?
I think so, yes. I think I have a very profound commitment to two systems of thought simultaneously. One, my place as an American, and simultaneous with that, my place as a Jew who tries very hard to come to terms with the most fruitful areas of modern life. I think that the best way that you encounter the world is by taking from it the best that it has to offer you, enriching yourself as a result, and then giving that combination back to the world. That constant mixture of fruitful elements is really what human civilization ought to be about.
Just briefly, because we're running out of time, do you think a lot of cultures and a lot of religions kind of breed a certain chauvinism, that this is the one and this is the best and don't really trust the others?
Yes, I think that's an infantilistic element of the human being, the notion that what I am is better than what you are. I think it's something that we had better learn to outgrow as quickly as possible, because if we keep that up, we're not going to be around for too long to brag about our own particular way of seeing the world.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you
for being back here on Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
My guest has been Chaim Potok, and he's a novelist, and his novels include The Chosen and My Name is Asher Lev, The Book of Lights. His latest novel, Davidus Harp, has just been published in paperback. He's also the author of the nonfiction book, Wanderings, A History of the Jews. And he also was the secretary of the Committee of Scholars that recently completed a new translation of the Hebrew Bible. And what it did was bring it up to date with contemporary English and also bring it up to date with contemporary scholarship. So the Jewish Publication Society had published it in three separate parts, and now one volume, including those three parts, has just been published. Thank you again for being with us. And I should mention Chaim Potok lives here in Philadelphia. It's 5:3. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening later this week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Of course, you've heard that the SEPTA strike continues in its first full day, and there is delays right now on all SEPTA trains running with 30-minute delays because of increased ridership and various other problems. Schuylkill Expressway westbound, slowly between 30th Street and Vine. On the eastbound side, a minor delay at University Avenue, an earlier disabled vehicle now cleared. Ray Street is at a clobber, just as many of the area streets are in Center City, Philadelphia, slowing from the Ben Franklin Parkway up to the on-ramp at 2nd and Race up onto 95, which is in relatively good shape as you make your way up toward Bucks County. That's Shadow Traffic. I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
The Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Superfresh. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by guitarist Raleigh Brown, who will bring his instrument and perform for us. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by conductor Dennis Russell Davies, who is about to become the music director of the city of Bonn, West Germany. Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by songwriter Ellie Greenwich, and she wrote a lot of the girl group hits of the 60s, including Leader of the Pack and Be My Baby. She was going to be with us last week, but she got the flu the day the interview was scheduled, so we've rescheduled for this Wednesday at 4 o'clock. Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air, my guest will be Dr. Carol Gilligan. She's a professor of education at Harvard University and author of the book A Different Voice, a study in the contrasting ways men and women define and develop morality. This Sunday at 6 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be Reverend William Sloan Coffin, one of America's most prominent and controversial ministers, and he'll reflect on his role as a peace activist and spiritual leader. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Technical direction today by John Knapp and Audrey Voblaitis. Production assistance from Judy Woglarski and Millie Moffitt. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller co-produces the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're a listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio. That will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Wendy Kaufman.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
You become somewhat of a mini celebrity as a black in South Africa. Ah, this person is different from our black, therefore we can relate to this person in a way we can't relate to our blacks.
Sam Fulwood and other reporters are granted international status in South Africa. Tonight on All Things Considered, the honesty and candor of South Africans when they talk about race.
And these stories, reaction to President Reagan's plea for aid to the Contras.
An assessment of the French election, the Conservatives win a surprisingly narrow victory.
In Stockholm, police charge a suspect with the assassination of Prime Minister Olof Palme.
Dairy farmers ordered to stop milk production. Their herds have been contaminated.